Today's Teisho will be on case 80 in the Blue Rock Collection, the Pien Lu, the Heikigan Roku. Case 80 is entitled Joshu's A Newborn Baby. Main subject: a monk asked Joshu, does a newborn baby possess the six senses or not? Joshu said, it is like throwing a ball into the rapids. The monk later asked Tosu, what is the meaning of throwing a ball into the rapids? Tosu said, nen after nen, without ceasing. Secho's verse, the six senses, purposeless. Well acquainted with it, the masters. A ball is thrown into the rapids. Do you know where it is carried? I want to thank you all for coming to practice Zen this morning. Many people today came at 7. And I know people have busy schedules. It's very hard to get up in the morning, whether you come at 7 or 9:30 or just to hear the Teisho. But a number of people, quite a large number of people, actually came and were here at 7 o'clock and have been meditating for many hours. And this is really a wonderful, wonderful way to live, in my opinion. You know, many years ago, my second teacher, Webb Roshi, was in China on one of his visits, and one of the temples had a over the doorway into the temple an inscription in Chinese ideograms. And the inscription meant, basically, it said, deep sitting makes humans not crude-spirited. Deep sitting makes humans not crude-spirited. That is the essence of our practice. You know, we all have a difficult life. Life is difficult. As a matter of fact, there is it's difficult in so many different ways that it's impossible to really imagine life without difficulty. We have problems with health. Hardly anybody has enough money. We have problems with chronic insecurity in our jobs. Wherever there are humans, there is hierarchy, and hierarchy creates its own forms of stress and confusion. Even with people we love, you know, people we love and trust, there are moments that are difficult. You know. So you know, it's life is challenging on so many levels, and we can get very, very discouraged, or very, very locked in. You know, sometimes it just you just feel like you've absolutely had enough. You know? Or you know, you can become sort of chronically angry, so that it's like you're ready to fight all the time. When I was going to school, and I lived for a while in Maryland. Bowie, Maryland. I had to go walk to school maybe a mile, couple miles. And every time I would be coming home from school, there was the neighborhood bully was there. And he would always grab me by the lapels and, you know, sort of frighten me. And I would try to forget about him. You know, I would try to forget about him, but every afternoon he'd be there and he would give me a hard time. It ruined school for me, for a while. Just this guy, at the end of every day, I knew I had to face this guy. A friend of mine rescued me, actually. There was a guy in our school whose name was Gary Faddick. Gary Faddick, I remember his name because he was my hero. And he was my rescuer. And Gary Faddick, he came down with me and he just, grabbed that bully and, he terrified him. And the guy ran away crying. It was so refreshing, right? And Gary Faddick was one of these guys who just, he was a fighter, I mean, when I was a little older, he was always getting into fights. He would get thrown out of school. He would start with his fists, So, that's another way to live, right? One way to live is to be afraid of the bully. Another way to live is like to be fighting all the time. These are different ways of living. Those ways of living, so many of our life choices make us crude-spirited, so that we don't, we become very fixed in these habitual ways of responding to the world. So I became very fixed in kind of like a fearful and cautious way of responding to the world. So I would, even after the bully was gone, I was still waiting for the bully, And there were other bullies, so I wasn't necessarily preparing unnecessarily, And Gary Faddick was like preparing in a different way. He was ready to fight. He just figured there was going to be a bully, there was going to be a fight, and you might as well deal with it. But both of us developed strategies for dealing with life that weren't necessarily that good. I wasn't really confronting my fear, and I wasn't really standing up to people who pushed me around, and I was running. In a certain way, and that became a kind of habit for me. And Gary was always fighting. You can't always be fighting. You miss a lot of life if you're always fighting. You miss a lot of life if you're always running. You miss a lot of life if you're very cynical. My brother had this incredibly funny, cynical, incredibly cynical sense of humor. My brother he was witheringly sarcastic but hilarious, and he could have people cracked up, they would literally be roaring with laughter, and he had this sense of humor that was very like a razor blade, it would just cut everything to pieces, but it was funny, he was funny. He was like he should have been a stand-up comedian. But just as you can't live life just being afraid all the time, and you can't live life fighting all the time, you miss a lot of life if you're a funny guy with a razor in his hand, and you're cutting everything to ribbons around you. You miss a lot of life. You don't have chances to be in love, You don't have chances to be a close friend, warm intimacy, a friendship, You miss things like that. If you're too afraid, you miss opportunities. You just don't take risks that could be really exciting. You just don't open certain doors. And if you're fighting all the time, you miss a great deal too. So we create in our lives these habits, these karmic habits, and we can get very locked into them. And when we're locked in, we become crude-spirited. And so, there's something really special about Zazen, and especially a lot of Zazen. And like what we're doing today, getting up, sitting for many hours, it's tiring, it's challenging, but also there's something really special about what we do. Something I would say very liberating about what we do. I was talking to a friend of mine who is very interested in comparative religion. And he comes from a different religious tradition, and he said, he was asking me some questions about Zazen, and he said, you know, I understand Zazen. He said, basically, we, in our tradition, he's like a priest, a Catholic priest. He said, in our tradition, we have something like that too. We call it centering prayer. And I said, actually, meditation isn't prayer. You know, and he said, oh, come on, you know, it is. And I said, no, I swear it's not. And he's a nice guy, you know, but he just didn't believe me. He said, no, it is prayer. You just don't know it. I said, no, really, it's not, I swear. It's not prayer. And he said, well, what do you do when you meditate? And I said, nothing. Nothing. And he said, well, you know, where does your mind go? And I said, it goes to a place where there's nothing. And he said, that's really God. And I said, no, it's not. It's nothing. Really, it's not God. It's nothing. And he said, no, I think it's God. And I said, really, it's not. You know, with all due respect to my friend, he couldn't get his mind around this. You know, he just couldn't get his mind around this. That when we sit, we're actually doing nothing. Nothing. You know, we're going to a place where there is absolutely nothing. And, you know, that's hard. You know, people, I mean, I've tried to explain this to other people, and they said, well, what's the use of that? What is the use of that? You know, what a useless thing to do. And, you know, I have to agree, yes, Zen is really, truly useless. You know? And you know, when people say, yeah, Zen is useless, usually they mean, but not really. But it really is useless. It really is useless. It really is nothing. You know, it really isn't prayer. It's something else besides prayer. It's, you know, it's really fundamentally different. You know, when we sit, we really have no objective. It's so hard to do that, right? I mean, you know, this is the discipline of sitting, is that most of us come to the cushion with an agenda. You know, so you know, we say, I understand, Zen is really about nothing, but it's really about enlightenment. You know, so the nothing is a road to enlightenment. You know, this is actually like a poisonous way to think. You know, it's like, you know, Zen masters, if you read the Mumonkan, they constantly say, don't try to become enlightened. Just be with Mu. You know? But you know, it's human nature to say, oh, I understand, I'll be with nothing, but then I'll be enlightened. This is how we humans are, you know. But, you know, if Zen was just a method to achieve enlightenment, it actually wouldn't be liberating, actually. You know, what makes Zen special is, and quite unique, is that we're absolutely doing nothing. And that's very hard for humans to do. You know, we come to sit, and, you know, I encourage people in bad habits. You know, after the sit is over, I always say, how was your sit? And I want people to say, great, wonderful. But, you know, basically the purpose of sitting isn't really to have a wonderful experience. There is no purpose to sitting. You know, when we come to the cushion, we usually have an agenda. And in the course of, say, 3 hours of meditation, our agenda is usually, we're usually disappointed in the pursuit of our agenda. You know, usually. You know, people come to Sesshin, you know, especially beginners, and they think, I know how it's going to go. Sesshin is going to go like this. I'm going to do a lot of Zazen, and then one day, I'm going to sit down on the cushion, and I'm going to have an enlightenment experience. And then everything is going to be different. And then life will make sense, and I will have a purpose, everything will be in its place, and so on. And actually, this is an illusion. You know, when you sit down on the cushion, you just don't know what's going to happen. And if you have expectations, they're usually derailed or disappointed. What happens on the cushion is usually not something you can predict, right? And actually, you know, it's a totally, totally open question what's going to happen on the cushion, or should be. It's difficult to get to that place. It takes a lot of sitting to just have the true wu-wei spirit, the true wu-wei mind, you know. Normally, we have a mind that is like purpose, get from point A to point B. And we could think about meditation as being like that too. It has a purpose, which is enlightenment or something. But actually, Zen is not about going from point A to point B. It's about not going at all, you know. It's absolutely purposeless. It's absolutely pointless. And so when we sit down on the cushion, we impose on the experience all of these expectations about what should happen. This is human nature. But in the course of our meditation, we're often disappointed. You know, we're often disappointed. I thought I was going to have a good sit, and all I could think about was my boss. My legs hurt the whole time. I was so sleepy, I could barely keep my eyes open. Or sometimes it's just, what happened on the cushion? Nothing. So you could say, well, what's the value of that? What's liberating about that? This week I was thinking very much about my grandparents. My grandparents are buried in Woodbridge, New Jersey. My grandfather worked in what used to be the Ford plant in Edison, New Jersey, all his life. And I was thinking a lot this week about my grandfather because I was reading something about what it was like to be a worker in a factory when my grandfather was a young adult. And this guy said, basically, he said that basically working on a line, like an assembly line, where you put parts together and made a car, he said was a combination, this is a guy who's done this kind of work, he said it was a combination of boredom and pain. That's what he said. Boredom and I think it was true. You know, I think, can you imagine, you know, I've had jobs like that, you know. I've had jobs, I didn't put cars together, but I've had jobs where basically all day long you're pushing your body to its limits and you're just doing something very repetitive, you know, like over and over again. And yet, you know, the jobs I've had have been pretty good. They've been outside, I've been building, I have had a lot of control over my time. If you're building buildings, you can just stop and rest. But in a factory, you can't really stop and rest. You have to produce a certain number of parts or work with a certain number of parts per hour. And they actually ring a little bell and you can go to the bathroom, you know. That's true. And then they ring a little bell and you can have a snack, and then you have lunch, and you come back, and so on. So, and by the way, this wasn't just for men. You know, a friend of mine told me that women who used to work at the FBI, they would have lots of women working at the FBI in typing pools. And again, they'd have a bell. You'd be working and working and working, and then there would be a bell, and that's a time for you could take a pee. And then you come back, and you have to type, you know. And for people in this period, you know, basically, life was, it was boredom and pain, you know. So people lived for not working, right? My grandfather, work was not the most important thing in his life. It was a period where, like going into a trance, he would go into the factory and he'd have 8 hours of boredom and pain, and then he'd come out and he would be liberated. You know, this is so typical of like working people, like 50 years ago, where people really saw, you know, there were jobs and the jobs paid pretty well, but they were boring and they were painful. And people would go in and they would work, and then they would, what they lived for was like the weekend, and what they lived for was the evening. So you'd have 8 hours of boredom and pain, and you'd go home, and you would have your family. Hopefully, it would be okay. You know, your wife would be there, your kids. You could have a meal. You could have a drink. You could watch TV, and you could breathe. You know, it's like you had control of your own time, right? And then the weekends came, and lots of people. My grandfather, you know, liked to fish. So, you know, he would sit in the factory all day and just be in pain and bored, and he would think of fishing on the weekend. And he had a little boat, and he'd get in the boat and fish on the weekends, and that was his life. You know, he lived for the freedom of the weekend, and he lived for the freedom of getting out of work. And work was like this period of just like a trance, where you'd just get in there, and you'd get out, and it had no meaning, you know. And, you know, my grandfather was like a union person. So he was very big, you know, basically unions fought to limit how much you had to spend in the factory, you know. So, like, when the whistle blew, everybody would just put their tools down and walk out. And this was a big deal. It was like, that's it. Now my time is mine. Goodbye. You know, this is how they thought. So their freedom was when they put their tools down, they could walk out of the factory and be free men, or free. And at the FBI, you know, the women could, 5 o'clock, pick up your purse, goodbye, your time is yours, you're not going to type another letter. Right? This is how, and now they were free women. They were on their free. So I was thinking a lot about this week, because, you know, we're not like this at all anymore. We're not like this. Our world has totally changed because the work really doesn't stop, right? You know, my grandfather worked in a factory, but he didn't think of himself. He thought work was something you did as little as possible, you know? So my grandfather didn't like to work. He didn't want to work. He wanted to be a free guy in his boat, but he knew he had to work. So, you know, he didn't love his job. He hated his job. But he did it so he could go fishing and have his wife and his kids, right? But modern people aren't like this. People today are very different, you know. First of all, the fun never stops, right? I mean, basically, you know, I get emails at 11 o'clock at night. You know, and I don't think I'm unusual. I associate with people who aren't in the academic world, and they all, you know, they stop, like, at the grocery store to look at their emails, and they're getting, you know, stuff from work. And it's like continuous work, right? It's just like continuous. It never stops. And the other thing that I think is very different is that people define themselves today very much by their work. You know, so people, you are what you do, you know? And so, I don't think my grandfather thought about things that way. He knew he had to work at the Ford plant, but that wasn't who he was. He was the person, he became himself when he left the Ford plant. And now he was a free man. That was him. That was Henry Spellmeyer. But now, you know, I think we define ourselves in terms of our work. That's who we are. And our work never stops. So I think it creates a very, very high-stress environment for people. You know, because if my grandfather was working on the line, and something stopped, you know, the line stopped or a part was defective and he had to pull a cord and stop the line, he didn't think, oh, I'm a really bad worker, you know? He'd think, oh my God, I'm a bad worker. He thought, screw you, you know? Screw you, right? This was how he thought, you know? And he didn't think of, you know, if somebody said, Henry, you were too slow today. It's like, well, what are you going to do about it, you know? So, you know, and then he would go home, and he was fine with it, you know? If his boss didn't like him, he didn't lie in bed and think, oh, my God, he doesn't think I'm a good worker. He thought, screw him, right? He's not going to fire me because I'm in the union, right? And I do my job, I put in my 8 hours, and I get my check. You know, but now, you know, we all lie in bed at night and we go, oh my God, you know, well, our identity depends on what people think of us, what our bosses think of us, and so on. And if they don't like us, we're really in a big, we're in a desperate situation, right? Because that's who we are, and it's our only identity now. You know, my grandfather had an identity outside of work, you know, and I don't have an identity outside of work, really, actually. Most people don't. I am my job, you know. And so if things go badly in my job, my whole world goes crashing down. You know, this is who I am, right? So this is like a very different world, you know, and it's a non-stop world. You know, it's like the work just, the fun never stops, right? You know, I get up in the morning and I sit and then I go look at my emails. And I've got emails, people are sending me emails at 6 in the morning. You know, and so I know those poor devils are on the internet too. Right? So this is like the total, and so many people now don't go to an office or a factory anymore. They work at home, right? And they're like freelancers. So my brother-in-law is a freelancer. What does it mean to be a freelancer? It means you don't get a regular check, right? It means you have to buy your own health insurance, right? It means 4 weeks from now, you might not have a job. You know, I'm not a freelancer. I work for the state of New Jersey. Every 2 weeks I get a check. I go into I have an office, you know. But lots of people don't have that anymore. They don't even have that security, right? They're just floating in this very 24-hour work environment, right? And they don't go to a factory anymore. When the 8 hours were up, my grandfather put his tools down. He was a machinist. He just put them down and he walked out. And if the boss said, "You're not done," it would just be, "It's in the contract, right? So long," you know. Now, you know, that's not true. If it takes 20 hours, you've got to put in the 20 hours because that's what that's what you've been paid to do. So you haven't been paid to be there for 8 hours. You've been paid for the job. And if it takes you 100 hours, it's too bad for you. So I think we're in a very, very difficult world. I mean, myself. I think people like my brother-in-law, I don't even know how he does it. You know, he's got a really, you know, he loves his life because he's very creative. He's like a, an artist, and he does metal work, and he works with architects, and his stuff is beautiful. But, you know, he's always like a couple paychecks away from just being broke, you know. And he pays a huge amount for his health insurance. So, you know, I think we're in a maybe I don't have to tell you all this. In fact, maybe as I'm telling you this, I'm making you more and more tense. But I think we forget sometimes just how much, you know, I think it's useful to think in these terms because normally we blame ourselves, right? I guess that's the point I'm trying to make. You know, we constantly think the fault must be mine. Something is wrong with me, right? But it's really not you. It's not, you know. The culture is asking a great deal of people. You know, it's really not you. The culture is a pretty screwed up culture, you know. So I think it's even more complicated than this because, you know, I think that we live in a world where we're constantly bombarded with information. It's like information overload, you know? So, you know, I myself am addicted to information. And after I meditate, while I'm eating my breakfast, I read the Huffington Post and I read Salon.com. And I go right to the environmental section and I read and it's like global warming, you know, this, blah, 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 you know, and it's like, oh my God, you know. So it's like doom. It's, you know, not only, you know, it's doom is on the way. You know, why won't they listen? Why, you know? And, you know, I think that the uncertainty in our life, and I also think that this information overload creates like a kind of feeling like a climate of panic. Panic. You know, I really do. I think that there is in our culture a kind of panic climate. It's like you just get to a point where you feel overwhelmed and then there's a kind of undercurrent of panickiness, right? And I think if you're panicked enough, you become depressed. So, you know, depression is quite widespread in our society because, you know, I think we're just on overdrive all the time. And we blame ourselves all the time for not being able to cope with, like, a superhuman environment that's very difficult. And so, on the other hand, there's nothing. There's purposelessness. I think there's something, tremendously nourishing about Zen. I really do. And people come in here, a lot of people, on Mondays and Friday nights we have our beginner's night. And people come in here curious, about meditation. They got a pamphlet at the activities day, or they saw the ad in the Targum. And they come in here and they're a little surprised by how difficult meditation really is sometimes. But sometimes people have a very positive experience, And last night, as a matter of fact, there was a woman who I didn't expect her to have a good experience because she was moving a lot on the cushion. After about 10 minutes, she started moving. About 15 minutes in, she had to stretch her legs, and then she brought them back. She was still only for about maybe 4 minutes at a time, 5 minutes at a time. So I thought, when I was going to talk to her, I was going to say, I said, how did it go? And I thought she was going to go, oh, that was tough. Interestingly, another woman who sat right next to her sat beautifully. Her posture was beautiful. She was probably Korean or Chinese. She sat down. She looked like a bodhisattva. Her body was balanced. She didn't move. So I said, how was your sit? She said, oh, not so good, But the woman who had the difficult sit, who had a lot of trouble, I said, how was your sit? She said, that was wonderful. See, there's something about this that I think is wonderful, that's really very liberating. That's very liberating. But what is it? What is it, How could nothing, how could purposelessness and so on be liberating? Well, when you sit down on the cushion, you really are experiencing nothing, and you might run away from it. Beginners, have a hard time getting to it. And sometimes people stumble into it and they just don't like the taste. They don't like the taste. There's people who just absolutely are terrified of that experience of just doing nothing, purposeless. But there's something about it that is really quite wonderful, What is it? One of the most exciting days I ever had was the day before I went to school for the first time. All the kids in my neighborhood in Baltimore had already gone to school. My friends were already going to school, and they would come home and talk about school. And I would think school was the most wonderful place in the world because that's where all the big kids went. And they would tell stories from school, and it was like Harry Potter. It was like, oh, how magical, And one of the used to watch a lot of movies on TV, and in the movies, there were always like these boy geniuses who were mixing test tubes and things like that. So I thought when you go to school, you would be like Mickey Rooney mixing test tubes, and they'd be funny explosions and things like that in the laboratory. I was so excited about going to school that I couldn't sleep, And when I got to school, they gave us a tour of the school, and at one point the teacher said, and now we're going to see the lavatory. And I thought, the laboratory, this is going to be great. Well, now we get to use the chemicals. I was wondering, when will we get to use the chemicals, the test tubes, and the bubbles. There'd be stuff bubbling, and we'd make explosions and things like that. And the teacher would laugh, and so on. It would be wonderful, just like in the movies, right? Just like Andy Hardy. With starring Mickey Rooney, So anyway, I was so disappointed when they took me into a room full of urinals. school wasn't totally a disappointment for me, you know. I found things that I liked. I discovered that I liked to read fiction, you know, I liked novels. I actually loved biology class, you know. So there were things in school that, you know, that were really interesting. And I'm glad I went to school, you know. There was that disappointment about the lavatory, you know. But there were other disappointments too, right? You know, there were some teachers who weren't so cool, you know. But on the whole, even though I didn't like taking standardized tests and things like that, and I had a lot of trouble with stress sometimes, I got a lot out of going to school. There was a moment, though, just before I went to school, I didn't quite know what was going to happen to me, but it was just like pure possibility, right? Pure possibility. Pure possibility. Yeah, I think Zen is about pure sitting in pure possibility. Nothing has emerged yet, but something is emerging. That purposelessness, that emptiness, is like sitting in pure possibility. It's so energizing. You know, when I do Zazen, after doing Zazen, I feel like I'm 10 years old again. Really, I'm not lying. I feel like I'm 10 years old. I feel like I'm that, whatever, 7-year-old who can't sleep because I could be going to the laboratory tomorrow, you know. And that those moments of possibility, right? You don't quite know what's going to happen yet, but something is going to happen and you're waiting with, you know, you're waiting with open heart for something to happen. That's really a wonderful way to live your life. Those moments are so precious. You know, when I first met my wife, I was very taken with her, you know. And I had fantasies about the kind of life we would live together, you know. And it just seemed like, you know, when everything, for a long time, in our first years together, you know, everything seemed like opening a new door, right? You know, so we're actually going to live together. We're going to, you know, before we got married, we actually decided, let's live together. Living together, what will that be like? You know, it was so exciting. Let's go shopping together, right? You know, now my wife says, let's go shopping. No! But then it was like, shopping. What must that be like, you know? So we'd go and buy a pan at this. Let's go, but we need to get some pans. Yeah, we need to get some pans, you know. So we'd go buy some pans. It's like an adventure. What do we buy? Should we get this pan? And we, you know, I don't know. That doesn't look like it's good quality. Yeah, we should get good quality pans. These have to last us for the rest of our life, you know. And that's kind of, you know, that. There's a moment, right? Moment where it's all so open. It's all so open, right? And it was so exciting when there was a freshness, right? A freshness. The first time, you know, first time we're sharing a bed. This is our bed. We just bought a bed. This is our bed. You know, let's lie in our bed. What do you think? It's pretty good, huh? You know, it's just I've been in beds before. This is like a new experience, right? My gosh, you know, this is our first night we're actually sleeping together, you know. Wow. You know. Now, you know, if we've been married for 35 years. It's like, you know, another, I mean, it's different, right? But you know, there was a moment there where it was pure possibility. And it was, things were so, ordinary things were so exciting because we had that openness. And, I have to say, I think most people who are married go through a period where everything becomes very stale, you know. But you know, I think we've been working, you know, we've been finding ways to do new things together, and sometimes it's possible to capture that feeling again, right? It's like, you know, we went to Paris this summer, and it was like that again. My God. My wife was walking around going, I can't believe we're in Paris. Paris, you know. Meanwhile, all these Parisians are walking by thinking, Paris, you know. You know, this woman we talked to said, "Oh, I hate Paris," right? She had just come back from Burma. Her name was Sophie Benita. And she said, "Oh, Paris, I hate to be back here," you know. And we were like, "Oh, this is, you know, sacred city, you know, this is." So for us, it had this tremendous possibility. For her, it was a closed door, and Burma was possibility. But those moments where you have that opening, they're so precious, right? You know, I don't have kids, but I imagine it's like this, you know, when you first conceive, when a couple first conceive, you know, you think, "My God, you know, we're going to bring life into the world. What'll he be like? What'll she be like?" You know, you don't even know, boy, girl? You know, what will this person be? It's just pure possibility. And it must be so exciting, you know, there's stress too, you worry, you know, "Oh my gosh." But there's this, the incredible pure possibility. You know, after the baby's born, it's a different story. You know, I had a good friend of mine in the Seattle Zen Center, Joyce Victor was her name. She was she and my friend Bill, they were both in the Zen Center. They finally had a baby, and I saw Joyce, and she looked like she'd been run over by a truck, you know. And I said, "Joyce, you know, you look a little tired." And she said, "You won't believe what I did, you know." She said, "I went to the, in New Jersey, you can't pump your own gas, but in Seattle, you have to pump your own gas. So if you drive into a gas station and you wait, you'll just wait forever. Nobody will come, you know. So in Seattle, you know, you pump your own gas, you know, and pay inside, or now you use your credit card." But she said, I filled my tank with gas, I got in my car, and I drove away. Oh, no. And the gas nozzle was still in her car. And she ripped it right out of the thing. It was like amazing, she said, you know. There's a safety mechanism, so, you know, gas didn't flow all over the ground, and somebody threw a cigarette down, and so on. That didn't happen. It just, you know, she said there was like an explosion. But she was so tired, right, you know. Now, you know, Bill and Joyce, they have their boys. They had two boys. They're grown up. One of them is trying to be a political journalist, and the other is in New York trying to be a Broadway actor, you know. And so it turned out to be great, you know. It was you know, who would have predicted, right? You know, it was pure possibility. I mean, you know, there was the original possibility, and then there was the reality, which was not what they expected. But now it's all turned out to be pretty amazing, you know, pretty amazing journey. So this pure this possibility is really wonderful, you know. Living with this at the center of your life, this openness, it's like you're waiting, you know. It's like something's going to happen, you know. It's hard not to feel, you know, in our life today, we're under so much pressure, and we can feel so boxed in. It's like a treadmill. And everywhere you turn, you know, you can feel very overwhelmed, you know, the panic, and then, you know, and depression. I think so many people are depressed because they can't get that freshness back. You know, you can't get that freshness back. You remember what it was like, you know, I remember the first time I went hiking. You know, I was in the Boy Scouts. My father put me in the Boy Scouts, and it was a disaster. I was not made for the Boy Scouts, you know. I didn't wear, my uniform always looked like hell. You know, when we would have inspection, I would always get points off. I was an incredible slob, you know. And you know, I was the kind of kid where my mother would send me to school with a jacket, and I would come home and she'd say, "Where's your jacket?" And I'd go, "Jacket? What jacket?" You know, "You have to go back to school and find that jacket." And I have no idea where the jacket is, you know. I'm still like that, you know. So anyway, you know, I was a washout as a Boy Scout. I was terrible, but we went on a hike. You know, we were going to go on a hike, a 50-mile hike. And I remember, again, a hike, you know, we're going to go off into the mountains, you know. What's it going to be like? You know, and I had seen all these Disney movies, you know, it would be, you know, like, it would be funny, and we would have a lot of laughs, and, you know, that sort of thing, and adventures, you know. It turned out to be totally different. You know, I ate some berries, and I got an allergic reaction, and my face swelled up, you know, and I couldn't, my hands swelled up, and you know, my father had to stay behind, and my father was the scoutmaster, and he was so out of shape, I thought he was going to have a heart attack. And, but you know, I still go on 50-mile hikes. You know, the summer before the last one, I went up into the Sawtooth in Idaho, you know, and I was just heaven, you know. So anyway, you know, what is this purposelessness? You know, what is the value of nothing? You know, but it's really great. You know, nothing is before something, just before something, just before something. See, I mean, for Western people, it's very hard to understand this because our culture is that nothing is bad. It's bad. Something is always better than nothing, we say. You know, something's better than nothing. But it's not true. Something comes out of nothing. Asian people grasp this like thousands of years ago. Even before Buddhism, you know, basically in the ancient China, the Taoists understood, you know, nothing is fertile. Nothing is fertile. Everything comes out of nothing. So for us, you know, nothing is like frightening or depressing or something, but it's alive. It's the livest thing. It's the most, you know, it's the most alive thing. See? It's like that lying in bed and thinking, I'm going to go to school. What'll it be like? You know, oh, I'm going to go hiking. You know, my first child. What is he going to be like? Maybe he'll be president of the United States, you know. Well, he didn't turn out to be president, but something special, right? A monk said to Joshu, "Does a newborn baby possess the six senses or not?" Joshu said, "It's like throwing a ball into the rapids." I mean, that's life, right? It's like throwing a ball. You don't know where it's going to go. But and you could be paralyzed. You know, paralyzed by fear, you know, But, you know, the sitting in pure possibility, in that, you know, pregnant emptiness, gives us, you know, it's like putting, sometimes when I meditate, I feel it's like I have a battery, it's like I have a cord from my umbilical cord, and I'm going to plug it into the socket next to me, you know. And I feel so energized, you know, I feel really energized. And it's very healing. This emptiness is very nourishing and very healing. It's sitting in that possibility, that life energy, just before things take form, anything is possible. You know, sitting in that anything is possible mind is what Zen is all about. The monk later asked Tosu, "What is the meaning of throwing a ball into the rapids?" Tosu said, "Nen after nen without ceasing." See, nen, it means moment. Nen. Nen is like a moment. Moment after moment. It's always a fresh moment. You know, if we can sit in emptiness, every moment has a kind of freshness. Kind of freshness. It's like a new baby. Joseph. A newborn baby. Every moment is a newborn baby. So hard. Takes a lot of zazen. But, you know, at some point, you get off the cushion and it's a newborn baby. And it's wonderful. It's just wonderful. You don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. What is the meaning of throwing a ball into the rapids? Tosu said, "Nen after nen without ceasing." Secho's verse. The question, the six senses. Purposeless. Why do we live purposeless? Well acquainted with it, the masters. A ball is thrown into the rapids. Do you know where it is carried?